Hi, I'm Gabby. Welcome to the Happier Life Project, brought to you by the free award-winning mental health and wellness app, My Possible Self. Today, we are looking at how to nurture the mind and body clock to achieve better sleep with Dr. Kat Ledler, a sleep and body clock scientist, author, and sleep coach who is passionate about helping others to sleep well and feel good. By now, we all know the basic good sleep hygiene principles. Don't have a heavy meal before bed. Avoid screens and devices. Keep your bedroom dark and cool, which is all well and good and helpful to an extent. But for insomnia sufferers, often the root of the problem lies far deeper than that. According to the Sleep Foundation, 2/3 of adults occasionally experience insomnia symptoms. And when we can't sleep, I don't need to tell you this, we feel rubbish. There's robust evidence demonstrating that sleep is critical to not only our physical health, but also our mental and emotional health too. If you're sleep deficient, you may have trouble making decisions, solving problems, controlling your emotions and behaviour, and coping with change. Poor or insufficient sleep has been found to increase negative emotional responses to stressors and to decrease positive emotions. And sleep deficiency has also been linked to depression, suicide, and risk-taking behaviour. Dr. Kat sees sleep as an act of self-care, and in her work with clients, combines sleep and body clock science with mindfulness, acceptance and commitment therapy, and compassion-focused therapy to bring her patients to a place of ease and relaxation before bed. I found it so fascinating talking to Dr. Kat, and I learnt a lot. I'm sure you will too. So, ready to find a healthier, happier you? Let's get started. Welcome, Dr. Kat Ledler, to the Happier Life Project. I'm delighted to be talking to you today. I think you're the first sleep and body clock scientist that we've had on the podcast. And I love the fact that you're a female doing this as well, by the way. So I thought it would be helpful if we can ease everybody in gently and sort of start off quite simply. Sleep is a basic need. Why is it so important?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating subject, sleep and the body clock and the combination. But why is sleep a basic need? Well, if you first of all look into Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right, sleep is right there at the bottom layer, at the most fundamental layer, with food, with water. So without sleep, we can't exist. And we see sleep or sleep-like behavior in all animals, even in flies and worms, you can sleep deprive them. Sleep, as in, if you measure it, looks different in these animals, but we see that rest and activity cycle there as well. Now, what happens during sleep? An awful lot. Probably can't talk about everything today.
Yeah.
But you can think of it as the body and the brain as them doing their repair and maintenance work. That's meaning during the day, we use up resources. We probably, as internally, you know, little pathways, they break and so on and so forth. All of that needs to be repaired so that we then can start our day afresh and do what matters to us and you know, do all the things that sort of keep us in a healthy state.
So on a biological level, without getting too complicated, I suppose, for people like myself and the listeners that aren't scientists, what is going on, I guess, both when we sleep, but then when there's a lack of sleep, what is happening to our body?
So when we sleep, the brain turns its attention inwardly. It's not that it turns itself off. The brain is always working. The brain is always processing. And the brain is always perceiving signals from the external world and from the internal, meaning from your body, right? It's just
the brain never sleeps.
Yeah, exactly. It never
Oh.
sleeps. It just changes its focus and it changes its activity patterns. And that's really how we know someone is asleep. If we hook them up with electrodes to measure their brain activity, we see a certain pattern when you are awake, and that shifts when we are asleep. And even while we're sleeping, that pattern rhythmically or cyclically changes, and that gives rise to the different sleep stages. Very broadly speaking, light sleep, deep sleep, and REM sleep, or commonly known as dream sleep. And they repeat these three stages, they repeat each other every 90 to 120 minutes. And during these sleep stages, the brain does slightly different things, or they have slightly different tasks to do. So REM sleep seems to be important for the processing of our emotional experiences of the day, sort of putting us into a more balanced or an equilibrium sort of a state, so that we're not as reactive the next morning. And we probably all know after a poor night or run of poor night, one of the things that's impacted is our mood, right? We're sort of much more reactive. The slightest thing can sort of trigger us in those moments. Whereas after a good night, we just don't bat an eyelid. So that's one thing. Then it's important for our physical health, and that's probably very much where the deeper sleep stages come in. That's really the growth and repair. That's when we, for example, see how the brain cleans itself of normal toxins that accumulate naturally during the day while we use our brain. Those are getting cleared away in the deeper sleep stages. And that may sort of have a role to play when it comes to dementia and Alzheimer's. We know dementia, Alzheimer's is related to the formation of plaques, so little things that accumulate in the brain. So there's this theory that, hey, if we don't get enough sleep in younger years, whatever young means, I mean, this is really broad, does that facilitate or contribute to the accumulation? It's not the only reason. I would never say, lack of sleep or poor sleep is the only reason. It could just add to other risk factors, and then maybe lead to later on to dementia. So that's there. It's important for our heart. It's important for our weight control. Sleep's important for the control of diabetes or regulation of insulin and glucose. So there's so much that sleep does for us that we don't think of, and in a way that we don't necessarily need to think of. I don't want, people to constantly be like, oh my God, I need to sleep, I need to sleep, I need to sleep, and put sleep on this pedestal, because then that can actually lead to tension, worry, and anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if we can turn our attention now onto a lack of sleep, which can present in many, many different ways. I'll give some examples. Maybe you can fall asleep okay, but then you wake up and you can't drift back off. Perhaps you lay in bed tossing and turning or unable to fall asleep. You might be disturbed in your sleep. If you've got a lot going on in your mind, maybe relationship issues, maybe you have a partner that shares the same bed and is a heavy snorer and that disturbs your sleep. Obviously, we know children is a big factor there, especially when they're very little. The list goes on, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In a way, it never ends. And I mean, in the way it never ends, because we're all so unique. And what can disturb our sleep is so unique. And yet, within that, there's something, the commonality, and that is around uncertainty and finding uncertainty difficult to handle. Because uncertainty sort of borders on there could be a potential threat. And the day we live in, it's not threat as in there's a bear or a lion walking past. It's very much in our heads. I could lose my job. You mentioned relationship. This relationship could come to an end. Where is it going? And so on and so forth, right? And then climate change is a whole another sort of Pandora's box. So it's very much in our heads. We think about it, but these thoughts impact the body nonetheless, and can sort of create what's called a hyperarousal. Sort of in a very alert state, an alert state, again, that sort of threat, not really safe. And when I'm not safe, the last thing my body will let me do is fall asleep, because when I'm sleeping, I'm most vulnerable for that bear, for that lion to come and attack me.
Interesting.
Again, lots of unique triggers or reasons, maybe, but if you look at it, there's often something very sort of common between all of us.
My follow-up question was going to be, is the biggest problem a busy mind? Because you know, some of the examples we've already talked about, whichever way, shape or form, you can't switch your mind off. And I also wondered as well if part of that is because in the day, we have so many distractions, don't we? Like work, kids, if you've got kids, friends, family, TV, podcasts, social media. And then when you go to bed and you're like, okay, it's time for sleep, then that's, I think, for most people, the time where the mind and your thoughts is up front and center. And I wonder why, if that's like, ah, now we have your attention, then the play takes place.
Yeah, it's exactly that, right? There's so much distraction that we, in a way, have to function from the moment we wake up. Be that, when I say be that true or not, what I mean is sometimes we can create that pressure ourselves. And of course, there's society, there's work, there's gender norms, particularly when it comes to women. And again, particularly there when it comes to mums. So that sort of gender pressure and so on and so forth, expectations. Anyhow, be that as it may, yeah, there's a lot coming at us and we have to react to that. And then finally, when we go to bed, yeah, that is really the first moment that we have to ourselves where there's quietness, where there's no more demands coming at us. And so the mind, who's been storing up all of that information and all of these questions and this unprocessed stuff from the day, is like, right, and now you're mine. And now we're going to think about all of this. And our mind is fantastic. It's so creative, which is super useful. But in that creativity, it comes up with lots of different scenarios of what might could happen. Now, one more thing, the mind has a bias towards negativity. So look at it from a doom and gloom perspective, again, just to keep us safe, you know. But then most of these scenarios are sort of colored, let's say, in a darkish way. That, like I said before, what we think about impacts the body can lead to a little bit of tension. Doesn't always need to be full-on panic or anxiety. Worry, that word, though, carries some uncertainty and anxiety with it, you know, can be enough to make it a bit harder to fall asleep. And then comes the thought, ah, I'm not asleep yet. I've been lying here for half an hour. I've got an early start tomorrow. I need to fall asleep. Come on, body, fall asleep. And the next sort of vicious cycle can start.
Yeah, absolutely. As I already made you aware, 80% of our app users and podcast listeners are female. And you're a therapeutic sleep coach who I think mainly works with women. I know you're very passionate about working with women. And I saw a report from the Society for Women's Health Research that there is a 40 to 70% higher prevalence of insomnia, if we use that as an umbrella term, in women compared to men. Yeah. So why are women, for the most part, far worse at getting a good night's sleep than men?
So there's probably lots of different factors. And it's not sort of as clear cut. But so first of all, we have biology, right? And our female bodies, and we have the changing hormones, starting with puberty, we've got our menstrual cycle. We know that these hormones, the sex hormones, can impact on sleep. And many women, not every woman, but many, say that sleep changes for the worse the last few days before the period starts, and then the first few days of the period of the menses. So that's something. Then we know sleep changes during pregnancy, right? Because there's another body for, you know, growing within you. Then it sort of can be uncomfortable to lie and so on and so forth. There could be worry, how will I be as a mum? So that whole level. And then we have menopausal transition, perimenopause, where hormone levels are very, you know, fluctuating. So that, again, will impact on sleep, will impact on the body clock. So that's the biology. We know women have a higher incidence of anxiety and depression. Anxiety and depression, they go hand in hand with poor sleep, which causes which? Different question. That's there. Then we have gender norms, as I mentioned before, in the sense that women in a partnership, or in the heterosexual partnership with children, no matter how modern it is still often the mother who is the primary caregiver, who picks up most of the household chores compared to the father. It hasn't really changed since the pandemic. So that leaves less time for sleep. Women also sort of are more of the carer, generally looking after the others, giving more rather than looking after their own needs. Yeah. So that can have an impact, for example, simply impacting their bedtime, going to bed perhaps later than their body wants them to go to bed, but still having to get up at 6, 7 o'clock, whatever it is, in order to meet whatever needs are, you know, put towards the mother the next morning. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
That's happening there.
So then, and obviously we have to talk broadly, what's the most common problem that you see with somebody that finds you and wants to work with you? And like, I'd love to know, because I don't know how sleep therapy works. Like, what are some of the things that you advise for somebody that is going through disrupted sleep or lack of sleep?
Yeah. So for me, it starts with an understanding. And I guess that's where my science mind comes in, wanting to understand the experience of the woman in front of me, right? That's really key. And that's what I meant early on. It is unique, where there are some common things in there, but the experience, the lived experience of having a sleep problem, of having insomnia, that's unique. And it's about understanding that, meaning what's going on at night. You mentioned, you know, it could be falling asleep, could be waking up in the middle of the night or waking up too early or whatever it is, really understanding that. And what's going on in the body and in the mind? It's not just to know, okay, I struggle to fall asleep. What's going on there? What's going on before? And that brings me onto the day, looking what's going on in the daytime, because night and day, wake and sleep, they go hand in hand. They impact one another. Right? Wake impacts on your sleep, sleeping impacts on the wake. So we have to look at all of this and really understanding this. I think that's, for me, is something sort of often said, but it is that. What is the experience of the person in front of me? And often there is a busy mind in whatever form. It's not always sort of as simple as racing thoughts, particularly if it has been going on for quite a long time. It might not be perceived so clearly. So again, it takes time to figure out what's going on. And then onto sort of what can we then do? And that's the next thing, right? To differentiate between what can I change and what can't I change? I can't change my biology. That is what it is.
Yeah.
Right. But I can change my relationship that I have maybe with my body in that sense, with the waking up. And it's not to say, waking up doesn't matter. You know, if I struggle to fall asleep, it's fine. You know, I will get through the day, no problem. That's sugarcoating it. No one really believes that. So that's not what I'm talking about. It's more about bringing self-compassion in and understanding, hey, this is, I'm struggling right now. And maybe for XYZ reason, right? This is tough for me right now. This is not what I want. How can I show up for myself? How can I support myself right now? Right? That's one part, the self-compassion. And the other is learning to distance yourself a little bit from your mind. When that mind comes, whether that's beginning of the night or middle of the night, it's like, right, and now we do all our worrying, and sort of grabs you and pulls you in.
Yeah.
Is to learn to just take a step back and go, hang on, what's going on here? That's my mind doing its thing again, because it didn't have a chance during the day to do all that thinking. You know, thanks, mind. I know you're concerned, but right now is not the right moment for this. Mm. You know, so you can go and you can bubble along over there, but I'm not going to engage with you right now.
Mm. And it's often when we're talking about the mind, it's not right now in the present that we're even considering, is it? It's the possible future outcomes that can bring on the worry and the stress, or we're ruminating on something that's already happened. But I've spoken to so many people when it comes to trying to quieten the mind. We know the techniques that are supposed to be helpful, like meditation and mindfulness, and I'm a massive advocate for breath work, but then I've kind of studied that a bit because I'm a yogi. But these things don't work for, there's no one size fits all, right? So yeah. I suppose there's got to be a bit of exploration there.
Yeah, and I think it's, dare I say, wrong to expect mindfulness, meditation and breath work to fix the problem, to quieting the mind, because that's not what they were designed to do, at least not to my understanding. It wasn't to quieten the mind, because that is just shorthand for getting rid of all thoughts, getting rid of all unpleasant feelings. That's not the intention of a meditation practice. The intention is to notice all that stuff that's showing up in the mind, all that stuff that's showing up in the body, but not to react to it.
That's
the non-judgmentalness, right? What is being talked about, to not judge what one has experienced. And that goes both ways, not judge it as in something negative or positive, because excitement is in a way physiologically the same as anxiety. It's alerting, it's arousing, it's just a nicer feeling, or we label it differently.
Yeah.
So it's not about that these things will work. I think that is in plain language wrong and unhelpful. It's not that they will quieten the mind, as in getting rid of thoughts. Because if that's my expectation and that's what's not happening, wow, I'm going to get really angry, frustrated, and blame myself for doing it wrong, because it works for everyone else to quieten their mind. When in truth, it doesn't. It's not set out to do that. It can maybe feel like this, but that's when I don't expect it, when I'm completely open, when I don't judge, if I'm not sort of wedded to any particular outcome, then actually, paradoxically, the mind can go quiet.
Yeah, that's really resonating, because we had Russ Harris on the podcast, author of The Happiness Trap and The Acceptance and Commitment Theory. I think he was like the pioneer for that, right? That's kind of what you're talking about, that when we have these thoughts, it's to not play with them, to not have a conversation with them, to just notice them and let them float away.
So he is a very big advocate. He's produced sort of a lot of popular books. It comes actually out of America, Stephen Hayes, but Russ has really helped to bring it, sort of make it
mainstream.
Mainstream, I guess. Training and it's exactly the way I work, or the model, the therapeutic model that I use with my clients, and really bringing in the self-compassion there as well. Yeah, it's the distancing from thoughts and also from emotions or sensations in the body. We often forget, but that, again, through this, what I said before, understanding, is this becoming aware, what's actually going on in my body? And very often clients at first say, oh, there's not much, you know, I'm just lying there. And then when we explore, actually there is stuff going on, which makes sense. Body and mind, they're not separate from one another. They're connected. They impact one another, and that shouldn't be forgotten.
I know that people sacrifice getting more sleep to, air quotes, make the most out of their day. So setting the alarm really early to hit the gym before work, because maybe they've got a full-on job, or again, with like busy mums, they might want to get up before the kiddos wake up to get a couple of hours of work done. I've heard that a lot. But do we sometimes compromise too much in this area? Like, we need to look a certain way, so we need to hit the gym, and maybe if this is our only chance to go, or is it really our only chance to go, or do we just want to get it done first thing? But then are we compromising our health in another way by maybe not achieving enough sleep?
Yeah. So if you ask me, you do exactly the latter. So for me, sleep is fundamental. It's the foundation for our health and well-being, where everything else sort of rests on. Right. So we know, you know, nutrition is important. Exercise, movement are important. And if you talk to a dietitian, you know, they'll say the nutrition is the foundation. So that's kind of, I think, depends where you come from. But for me, ultimately, if you don't sleep, the best diet or the best exercise regime, whatever that is, it's going to fall through the cracks. It's got nothing to stand on, because sleep is where the body gets its time for growth and repair. And that's physically, that's psychologically, emotionally, right? And if I cut short my sleep time, I cut short this maintenance work. And then for me, like I said, the exercise and nutrition, it will fall through the cracks. Now, if they either have a mum, just like you mentioned, there are lots of mums who get up a bit earlier or stay up longer at night to get some work done. Yeah. I think fundamentally, and this is where I become a bit activist, there's something wrong with how society works, how parents, how mums are supported, but generally with how society works. Because we really believe in this, the early bird catches the worm. So we all have to start work at 8, 9 o'clock. 10 if you're lucky. And then, well, it used to be, you know, finish 5 or 6. Now, of course, it goes much, much longer in the evening. We all have slightly different sleep times. We have a different chronotype. Some people are early, some are late, the rest fall somewhere in the middle. And these differences in sleep times or sleep windows then, of course, also translate into when we are best at sort of with our cognitive performance during the day, and the same with our physical performance when it comes to more exercise, that type of thing. So ideally, we would match people's work times and for children, their school times according to where their body clock lands, right? And so that would certainly help. And then I think we just really have to ask ourselves, do we need to do all these things? Again, it will be different for a parent, but for many others, I'll have to do this and this and this, and I have to be seen doing things, right? No one wants to be seen as lazy. We have to have X many hobbies or side hustles and whatever it is, be present on social media, and then also how, not just be present, but of course, in a certain way. There's so many shoulds that we apply to ourselves. For me, that physiologically translates into tension as well as psychologically into tension. And that's hard, you know, when it comes to sleep, being in that state. And you're not a machine. You can't just flip a switch and say that this tension is just gone. It takes a bit of time for all of that to go, if it goes at all.
Some people claim that they only need 4 or 5 or 6 hours of sleep. I personally cannot function if I get less than 7.5. Between 7.5 and 8.5 is my sweet spot, and I can really, really feel it. I mean, I'm just, yeah, I feel ugh, the whole next day if I've not achieved, you know, the mentioned. So these people that claim they only need 4, 5, or 6 hours sleep, is that true, or have they just convinced slash trained themselves to function with this? How much sleep do we actually need?
So the vast majority of adults, of healthy adults, the recommendation is 7 to 9 hours, right? That's for the vast majority of people. Now, let's just say you mentioned you need at least 7.5. So you get that. You probably can deal with a night of 7 hours, won't feel as great, but you can deal with that. And there will be a natural variation sort of for you, in how much sleep you need. Now, some people need sort of less, around the 6 hours, but those needing sort of less than 6, 5, or 4, that's one percentage of the population. You know, we can't all fit in there. Now, you said something. Have they trained themselves to, or is that their perception? They haven't trained themselves to need less. What your body needs is what it needs, full stop. It's a bit like what the body needs to maintain your weight, your healthy weight. That amount of food is what it needs, right? So we can't train ourselves to need less sleep. However, what happens when we don't get enough sleep, as we spoke about in the beginning, it impacts the body, it impacts the brain, it impacts the brain's perception of the world and of ourselves. And there's a beautiful study done, I think 20 years ago now, where they brought people into the sleep lab for 14 nights, split them into three groups. One group was allowed to be in bed for 8 hours, one for 6, and one for 4 hours. And then during the day at regular intervals, they were asked how alert they felt, and they did a computer test as an objective test, right, for their performance. Now, when they were asked subjectively, you know, how alert do you feel? The first, I don't know, 4 nights or so, the group which slept for 4 and 6 hours, they said, oh, yeah, a little bit more tired, a little bit more tired. But then it plateaued. Basically, their subjective feeling of alertness was a little bit reduced, but then was just one straight line, not flat, straight line. Objectively measured their alertness, their performance. The researchers saw a constant decline over the course of the 14 days. So what that shows is that my perception, when I'm sleep deprived, my perception of myself, of my performance is warped, right? I actually have not an objective ability to assess just how bad my performance is. And that is probably what's going on for these people. We did this, they're not really getting used to it, but there's a sense of, because the brain is impaired, there's the sense of, oh yeah, I'm used to it now. But as soon as they sleep for what, let's just say 8 hours for the sake of it, they notice the difference in how they feel. And that's really shows you, you know, you can't train yourself to need less sleep.
That's so interesting. Well, as you very clearly demonstrated, the correlation between mental health and sleep is, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because if you've got mental health problems, studies have shown that it's very likely your sleep is not going to be that great. But then if your sleep isn't that great, that can really aggravate, you know, any mental health problems too, such as, I think anxiety is the big one, isn't it? So if you're feeling anxious, then it's hard to go to sleep because you're just not in that state of relaxation when you're in bed. But then if you don't get enough sleep and you wake up, then if you suffer from anxiety, that is just going to be massively amplified. So what to do?
Yeah, what to do? You have to treat both. You have to treat the mental health disorder and what's going on with sleep. And what we have to consider much more when we look at sleep is also the body clock, circadian rhythms, right? Mm-hmm. The circadian health, the impact of disrupted rhythms independent of sleep and in connection with sleep on mental health and again, vice versa. So we have to really look at both that needs to be treated. I think that's what it is. And for me, it really starts with prevention and educating people, including teenagers, on the importance of sleep, but not in the way that sleep is put on a pedestal, because I think that's not helpful. It's to normalize it and just to educate, raise the awareness that sleep is a foundational need, just like food and water and social connection. Yeah. Treat it as something normal. You know, we all can do it. We all do it, good or bad, but we all do it. It's normalizing something here, not make it like super special, but equally, you know, raise awareness that it does matter. And like I said, doing it already for teenagers, and then carrying that through.
I think that this was moving on to my next point. I think they are definitely ones that do this bedtime procrastination. So like this is where a lot of people enjoy their me time, and I completely get it, and I'm guilty of it myself as well, that this is where you get to, you know, binge watch this TV series, finish that good book, whatever, whatever. Also, I think quite a few people dread going to bed and have the bedtime scaries too, because there's something about just switching off, or, well, now we've learned that the brain never switches off, but there's something about being unconscious even that just... something just doesn't feel good about that. So what do you have to say about bedtime procrastination?
So we have to really look at what's the driver here. And you said absolutely me time is a big one. And that comes up with so many of my clients. And there we just, again, it's that, you know, unique situation. How do we go about this? To just say, oh, you can't use your phone from 9 p.m. onwards. Well, most likely we are going to use it at 10, and then we feel bad that we went against this rule and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, back we are to tension and I'm so bad, blame myself. And no one is going to fall asleep. So it's just kind of finding out, okay, how can we do it in the most helpful way? You know, acknowledging what biology needs, darkness, and what you psychologically need, a bit of sort of connection, distraction, whatever it is. But there's one other part of this bedtime procrastination, and that is a delayed body clock. And that is what a lot of teenagers have. And it's got nothing to do with the phone or whatever screen device you're using. It has to do with a teenager's delayed body clock, meaning that shifts, that body clock, which sets the timing for our sleep, when we go to sleep, when we wake up, has shifted to a later time. And the entire sleep window is shifted because they still need 8, 9, 10 hours, depending on their age. But it's just shifted to a later time, which means they actually want to wake up later in the morning as well. Well, we've got school starting for everyone at 8, 9 o'clock, whatever it is, meaning that for teenagers, their sleep is cut short, right? Yeah. Which can potentially have an impact on their grades. There are studies to show that it does.
Not just for teenagers as well. I think people that do the traditional 9 to 5 or 9 to 6, that applies too, right?
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Going to bed late and then having to get up.
Yeah. I'm just thinking for a teenager, you know, it's still the developing brain in that sense.
Okay.
So there, the detrimental impact of that, of the lack of sleep and so on and so forth, you know, we don't quite know what that is, because, you know, we haven't researched it, as in, because sleep, circadian rhythms, is relatively young. as a field compared to other fields. So, you know, a lot more understanding needs to be gathered.
Yeah.
And but you're right, you know, for an adult with a delayed clock and a night owl, it's the same, right? And we see there again sort of a correlation with poor mental health, but also poor physical health with the night owls. Probably because of mistimed sleep and lack of sleep. So, but coming back to your bedtime procrastination, so it's important to look at this. Okay, this person here, is this a delayed, you know, delayed body clock, adult or teenager? Is that playing a role? Because someone with a delayed clock, let's say the clock says go to bed at 1 or 2 a.m., for them to go to bed at 10 p.m., well, they can go to bed. They're not going to fall asleep. It's very, very unlikely. And they can use as much willpower as they like.
Yeah.
The clock hasn't said it's sleep time. So they are actually most alert in that moment because, you know, they're there for their brain. It's still daytime.
Can we really change our body clock, though? Because I've tried it myself. I'm definitely in the night owl camp, but I love my yoga. So I've tried and tried and tried. And even when I went to India and studied it and stuff, and where I was having to get up at sunrise and whatnot, I can't switch off before a certain time and wake up before a certain time if I don't have to be up, you know, for something. Can we alter that natural? Because there's sort of buzzy kind of quizzes that you can do online to find out, are you a bear or an owl or whichever animal? And you're shaking your head. Shaking your head there. And I want to be an early bird, but I just can't. And then anytime I've really tried to train myself, I've felt rubbish because I haven't had enough sleep.
So you can shift the clock somewhat. And we shift it every time we cross time zones. If we go to, you know, the US or Australia, something like that, we shift it. But can you shift your clock in the place where you are? You can, but to what degree? I think it will vary for people how much, how far they can do it. And it's not easy because in your case, so you have to get up early, you have to immediately expose yourself to light in that moment. You have to obviously shift everything else when you eat, when you exercise, when you work, all of that has to shift forward. And then when it comes to the evening, for you, it's very important to make it dim or dark as early as you can, because it could be, and this is again where more research is needed, that you are late, I'm an early, that you may be more sensitive to light in the evening than I am sensitive to light at the same clock time. Yeah. So therefore, really important to make it dark or dim, you know, and generally to calm everything down. Now, the mind will be like, oh, what's going on here? What's going on here? Will this work? So then it's about finding ways of how to handle that perhaps worrying mind or maybe just inquisitive mind in that moment. How do you fill that time, basically? I'm wondering, when you just said you went to India, right, to study the yoga, how much electric light there was, I have no idea. So I'm careful to not sort of bring up any cliches. I could imagine maybe that there was less electric lighting, at least not very bright, maybe more natural light.
Yeah, I'm smiling because it's a thing in India. They just have power cuts all the time. So sometimes the lights would just go off anyway. But I mean, I was, for at least a month of it anyway, I was on a quite intensive training schedule, where the day, you know, I had no say. So the day started at this time and finished at this time. And it was bang, 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 classes, 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 you know, to learn how to be a teacher of yoga. Yeah. But then as soon as I got back to Western life.
Yeah. So yeah, it would be interesting to know, you know, look back at how was it then with that very structured day?
Yeah.
Did that feel at the end a little bit better? But certainly, yeah, coming back to the Western world, let's call it just for the sake of this. Yeah, you're probably your old life and how life is structured here is not helpful. I mean, our modern age is, we see more late people or delay of the body clock because of the electric lighting, right, available in the evening and how we generally live our lives. There's a huge shift. There's this study where it was with students done in the US, University of Boulder, Colorado. Anyway, they went camping And they measured sleep before they went camping, as in sleep times, and while they were there. And there was no electric lighting. And they saw that distribution of, you know, earlies somewhere in the middle and late. But when they went camping, everyone shifted to an earlier time. You still had the same, you know, larks and owls, but they all collectively shifted to a slightly earlier time because of the lack of electric lighting.
Well, I love my candles, so maybe I should give this a go.
Yes.
In terms of healthy sleeping habits, what are some that we might adopt? Obviously, the light thing you've covered. Mm-hmm. What else? I'd love you to mention as well, because I picked this up on a different podcast I heard with you talking about diets and not just what we eat, but when we eat it as well. So that needs its own body clock to work with your sleep body clock.
Yeah, absolutely. So the body clock is really an area in your brain that sets the timing for everything that happens in your body. It's just that sleep and wake, that rhythm is sort of the most pronounced. But we see circadian rhythms everywhere in your heart rate, in your blood pressure, hormone release, and so on and so forth. Your stomach, our ancestors evolved to be awake during the day, to eat when it's light, and to not eat, rest, sleep when it's dark, right? And so the stomach has a circadian rhythm, or digestion generally has a circadian rhythm, meaning that if we eat later at night, whether that's cheese or, let's say, a cracker, the stomach isn't ready to deal with it. Now, a cracker is easier to digest than cheese, yeah? But fundamentally, the stomach is not ready to deal with it because it's just too late in the day. So, yes, there's a lot going on research in chronobiology. So that's where circadian rhythms fall into and diet. And yes, what we eat and when we eat. And generally speaking, it looks like, you know, having a shorter eating window. So less than 12 hours is supportive for not our sleep, not just our sleep, but our health, our overall health generally. Yeah.
So this whole fasting thing, right, that's become a bit of a trend, or fasting window.
Yeah. It's kind of mimicking what our ancestors would have done.
Right.
What animals do, we have to pick the right animal though, but what animals do as well, you know, we have food available. We can go to the supermarket at any time of the day, night, and get food or have it delivered to us. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because sometimes it's needed, but it's maybe not always for the best. Looking at your eating window and how that fits in within your sleep-wake window, and that brings me to sleep-wake window, it's about finding out, what is my sleep window? What are my sleep times? Like, you know, you're more of a late. I know I'm more of an early. What are they? How much sleep do I need? And then how can I generally structure my day to sort of meet my sleep needs? And it won't be possible for everyone given the nature of job or family demands. So it's then looking, okay, where can I make changes? Where can't I make changes, right? How can I use light exposure to maybe shift my body clock, doing these things? So I think that's really important. And allowing a bit of me time, again, whatever that looks like, and how long that is, and when exactly that is within your waking day. It doesn't need to be in the last 2 hours before you go to bed. It could be 5 minutes before you go to bed. It could be at 4 p.m. But just a bit of time where, okay, and now I have a breather and I do something that I enjoy, whether that's alone with other people, again, doesn't matter. It could be scrolling on your phone, but a sense of, I've done something for myself today. Just things I had to do where I had to function, but something for myself today. I think that's really important.
That's really interesting. When I asked you about the whole tip thing, that it was more going inwards and looking at your day versus, I guess, what we already deep down know, limit the screen time before bed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the sort of sleep hygiene rules, right? That word rules is already something I don't really resonate with. Most of my insomnia clients, they know all of this. They apply all of these rules.
Right.
And they're good. Again, I'm careful with the word rules, but these habits, yes, absolutely. But they don't guarantee a perfect night. And it's also how I apply them, with a sort of expectation, tension, rigidity, or because, these are just healthy habits. And if I don't do one habit this night, then I do it tomorrow night. That's fine. It's a bit more fluid, but yeah, I think it's much more what's going on within me and my response to what's going on externally, that we need to look at and consider.
Yeah, definitely. A lot to do with the mind for sure. When is it time to seek professional help to find somebody like yourself? How bad does it need to get?
When it's been going on probably for more than a couple of weeks or more than a month, and you feel your perception is, hey, this is having an impact on me, on my relationships, on my health. Short-term sleep problems are, dare I say, normal, or rather are a normal response to stressful events, whatever we find stressful. But if that continues for longer, particularly if there's this worry, or will I sleep tonight? Then I would say, reaching out for some support.
So if, say, for example, we wanted to reach out to you, your website is drcatsleep.com.
Correct.
That's the best way to find you. And yeah, you've got a book called Sleep Sense. So, and thank you so much for all the information that you've shared today. It's a fascinating subject. Your book, Sleep Sense, so this is drawing on your academic knowledge and experience as a sleep practitioner, taking the reader through the science of sleep and why it is important for every single one of us, irrespective of whether you're a short or long sleeper. Yeah, anything to add there, Dr. Kat?
No, really. I mean, for me, it was writing this book is, again, raising the awareness of what sleep does for us, right? Without creating any scare or anxiety. It's just to introduce, hey, this is the behavior you do for one third of your life. You do it every day, as in according to the 24-hour day. This is what's happening, and this is why it matters. This is how it's helpful. And equally, yeah, if you don't get it, what then can happen? So that's really is sharing my fascination for this behavior with everyone else.
Can I ask really quick, what do you think about the snooze button? Because I sleep really, really well, but dragging myself out of a bed, I think it's since my sleep environment is so, maybe I've made it too comfortable.
No. You said you're a late person, so it could be something to do with that. What's my view? So there's some studies recently coming out that said it's not that bad, but again, there's no long-term study. So for me personally, first of all, needing to wake up with an alarm clock means you're cutting short your sleep, right? If you didn't
I have
have that, your
blackout
body would
blinds.
continue.
Is that anything to do with it? Because I'm not letting the natural light wake me up.
It can, because light is a signal for the body clock that daytime is starting. Even with your eyes closed, you can perceive light, right? And our ancestors didn't have blackout curtains. So while they were technically sleeping, as the sun was rising, that information would have been passed on to the clock. The clock would have been like, okay, she soon needs to wake up. Let's get the body ready so that when she opens her eyes, she's ready to go. If we had blackouts, that transition doesn't happen, right? It's a very harsh change from one state to the next. So I would say, and this is what I do, always leave the curtains open just a little bit. Being wary, of course, in the summer light coming up, the sun coming up earlier, but having a little crack to have some light come in. And with the snooze button, personally, I would say put it to the last snooze alarm that's possible, and then maybe set five alarms or something like that.
I do.
Different sources, whether you do, and do it that way. And then when they all go off, get up, open the curtains, let the light in. That's really important.
Okay, thank you. Okay, this is the Happier Life Project's last five in five, the same five questions, quick fire that I ask every guest to close the episode. When and where are you at your happiest?
At home with my husband and my two cats. It's, I think being with them is at home. We don't necessarily need to be in the flat. We could be out in the park, but being with them because of the really deep felt sense of relaxation. And I think it's the support, particularly I get from my husband.
What's your favorite thing to do that nourishes your mental health?
That I think is going for a walk. It's going for a walk with my brother's dog, which I do very rarely, but that is probably the most refreshing.
What piece of advice do you now know that you wished somebody would have told you earlier that would have made you a happier person?
It's okay to do your own thing and to sometimes not know exactly what that is or where that leads you to.
What is the most important one thing that needs to change to make the world a happier place?
acknowledging that we have different sleep times, because I think when we sleep better, we are happier, we are friendlier, we are better at problem solving. Yeah.
Finally, what is a simple actionable step that we can take when it comes to improving our sleep health that will help us to live a happier life?
Oh, that's a big one. Allow yourself to be, meaning that if you're in bed and you're not falling asleep, allow yourself to be in that state. Because when you allow, your body can relax. And when your body can relax, tension goes and you can actually fall asleep.
Amazing stuff. Thank you so much, Dr. Kat. You're awesome. Loving the work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's Gabby back with you. Thank you again to Dr. Kat Ledler. And thank you to you for listening to this very episode of the Happier Life Project. Just one more minute of your time, please. And that's for the all-important housekeeping. If you are suffering with your mental health, there is a crisis button on the My Possible Self app, which will signpost you to the correct information for immediate expert advice. Those of you who are listening on one of the podcast platforms, the My Possible Self app is completely free to download and access all of the content, so you don't need to worry about it costing you anything. If you are in crisis or you think you may have an emergency, please call your doctor or the emergency services immediately. The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the interviewer, which is me, and the interviewees. The content of this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a substitute for professional or medical advice. Our partners at the Priory Healthcare are not involved in the production or content of this podcast. Please do subscribe and leave a review if you're listening to this on one of the podcast platforms. It helps us to expand our reach and help others in need. And if you're not already following us on social media, we are at My Possible Self and I've been at Radio Gabby. Do take care. And I'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.